Georgia's DBHDD is urging people to ask a pharmacist about getting naloxone for their first aid kits at home or work. No prescription is needed. Naloxone can rapidly reverse an opioid overdose and restore breathing. Opioidresponse.info.
Thanks for listening to the Political Rewind podcast. Be sure to like and follow us and rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. It's time for another edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We're now 12 days into the legislative session, and it's not unusual. The first week or so, things were fairly slow down at the state capitol, but now they're beginning to pick up in terms of activity and introduction of bills that are going to get a lot of attention, I think, throughout the session. They just passed yesterday what they call the mid-year budget, $32 billion for this mid-year budget, which includes, you've heard a lot about on this show and in the news, about the $1 billion in tax cuts that will give homeowners and individuals some breaks on their taxes. There's money for school safety and other matters. And now, of course, they have to go to work on the big budget, which sets the tone for the fiscal year, which starts in July. But in the meantime, there are a lot of other issues that are bubbling to the surface, and we're going to talk about those things and a lot more on today's show. So let me get right to the panel. It's Friday, which means my partner is Jim Galloway, the former political columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Jim, so glad that you're with us. How you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm just surprised that so much is happening without me, you know?
And you have said repeatedly you don't miss it at all, which I guess is a wonderful thing. Good for you. But thanks for being here.
Those days at the Capitol are well put well behind me. Yes.
Yeah. Those marble floors get to your after a while are really hard to walk across. Emma Hertz with us. She is a reporter for Axios Atlanta. Hi, Emma. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. But I don't know if I believe that Jim doesn't miss it even a little bit because he's still here talking about it.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I definitely understand.
Yeah. Rounding out the journalists on today's show, Meg Kinnard, who's a national politics reporter for the Associated Press based in South Carolina. And a little later in the show, Meg, I want to talk to you about a lot that's happening in politics in South Carolina. But I think it's also, I think I'm right also that you're from Memphis, right?
I am. Yes, I am from a West Tennessee native. That's true.
So the Tyre Nichols story, I would think, has a special maybe resonance for you.
It does. You know, I'm at the point in my life where I've lived outside of Memphis longer than I actually lived there. But when you see a place that's special to you, that has been special at some point, go through such a time of reckoning and disruption, that always kind of literally hits home. And so my thoughts are definitely with the people I know and love that are still in Memphis. And I hope my city continues to heal from all of this, because it certainly has been a trying time for Memphis as well as for the nation.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for being here. Adrian Jones is back. We're really happy to have you back, Adrian. Adrian teaches political science at Morehouse College and is also the director of pre-law at Morehouse. How's the semester going for you so far, Adrian?
We are into the semester. Things are going quite well, humming along.
What are you teaching this time out?
I have national government, which is essentially American government with what I think is a funner name, and constitutional law. So, you know, both allow us to talk about rights issues, like the kinds that are going on right now, as well as fundamentals. You know, how does it work and what's supposed to happen versus what is actually happening.
Yeah. What great classes to be teaching at this moment in our history. All right, let's get right to it. Jim Galloway, we know that for well over a year, in fact, well, I take that back, it's probably going on 3 years now, since Governor Kemp first applied for two waivers from the federal government for how he would deal with Medicaid and health care in general in Georgia. And the one that's of interest to us, I think, today is the one he applied for, which would allow Georgia to block healthcare.gov, the federal website that people use to shop for insurance, and put in its place a website run by the state, which would we don't really know exactly because we haven't seen it rolled out in a way that we would know what's going on, but essentially allow private insurers to offer plans to people in Georgia. The Trump administration had approved that waiver, but the Biden administration pulled it back. All of that, I say, to point out that while the waiver is still not approved, there's now a bill in the legislature that would allow Georgia to do just that, block the ACA website in favor of the state site. And I should add, this comes at a time when we have just seen record enrollment in Georgia on the ACA healthcare.gov website, well over 800,000 people. Jim?
Right. And I'm kind of puzzled. I'm not sure exactly how a state action might erase access to a federal site. But what's money is at stake here. Maybe as much as $100 million in fees generated by that website in Georgia. And right now those fees go to things like navigators to help people through to find the kind of policy that they need, and this would give Kemp the power to spend that money as he sees fit, and he has been emphasizing reinsurance in order to bring down health insurance, but not for the most needy people, not for people below the poverty line, but for people with middle incomes.
Yeah, Emma, that's one of the things that's interesting about this. One of the reasons that ACA enrollment has picked up in Georgia and other states is that the Biden administration has added incentives for people of lower incomes to get their insurance at a cheaper rates. But from what we can tell about the Kemp plan, as Jim points out, those incentives and those that reinsurance concept won't go to the lower earners. It will go to people in higher income brackets.
I think that Jim is right on here, that the money is at the core, right? And a state taking over its marketplace is not political. I mean, both Democratic and Republican states already do that around the country. But what I think is so interesting in a big picture way is if we think back to Kemp's first campaign, he really didn't talk much about healthcare back in 2018, whenever that was, and then immediately pivoted once he was elected and invested a lot of time in these proposals. And has put in a lot of time since and money in defending them in the courts, trying to explain them to journalists. His staff has spent a lot of time doing that, realizing that this is a big problem and realizing, I think, in a way that in 2018, at least Stacey Abrams really was arguing something that he didn't have much of an answer to policy-wise. And so this continued focus on it and trying to see these proposals, this limited expansion and tweaks to the system to try to make some progress, still something that he recognizes is a problem. And I guess, again, the question to what you're saying becomes like, what is the effect at the end of the day? How many people does this really help? Is this going to be enough to make a difference?
Yeah, that's right. You're referring, of course, when you talk about limited, you're talking about the other waiver, which is now going to go into effect in probably the summertime, in which the state will offer a limited number, maybe as many, they're now saying, as 90,000 people to go on Medicaid as long as they do work or some kind of community service in exchange for the benefit. And Democrats have said, why not just expand it to all the 400,000 or so people who need it? Meg and then Adrian, the issue about changing over from the ACA website, I think, to a state site it's hard not to think about the political in all of this. I mean, Republicans have fought Obamacare since it was first introduced. They continue, well, they're not doing it so much anymore because the public has obviously finally said we sort of like the Affordable Care Act. But so it's hard to remove the politics from this in thinking about what are the practical reasons the state might do it.
Thinking exactly along the same lines, I was having those thoughts when Jim and Emma were talking about this. You know, we remember back to the earlier days of the Obama administration when Republican-led states were engaging in all of this litigation over the ACA and over expanding services in their states and over, well, you know, obviously we saw that litigated to the ultimate degree of whether this is constitutional that people do this. And so, yes, clearly the public sentiment about these services and the way that healthcare and health insurance and health coverage is meted out on a local citizen level, a lot of that has changed. But still, for Republicans aiming to be able to argue to their constituents, look, this is something that I still oppose, that people who share my political ideology still oppose. This, on the point of the governor in Georgia and some in other Republican-led states, this is the newest frontier for that. It's kind of a micro level of still opposing the ACA while still acknowledging that it's being available to people. But, you know, we as the state should be the ones that are conveying that as opposed to this federal purported overreach that conservatives would, you know, politically we expect argue against in terms of the federal government being the ones to meet that out.
Adrian?
I guess I feel similarly, that it just feels political at base. You're talking to me about a state-run program that you're not explaining to me what it is. This, you know, meanwhile, healthcare options for Georgians who are in dire need are available, and that's not being applied in a widespread manner. That just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. It also seems to me that it might be of political benefit to the governor to have, you know, provided people more of the healthcare opportunities that they need. So it just sort of leaves me confounded, especially where there's no clarity around, you know, what is the state program going to be?
Jim,
do have to add, there are a couple Democratic co-sponsors on this legislation. It's not just Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important point. No, I'm glad you mentioned that. I think that's an important point. Jim, let's talk about this from a political point of view in terms of Governor Kemp. Here's a governor who was just reelected by like 8 points, defeated his primary opponent in an overwhelming victory. He is at the peak of his powers in this session right now. And I'm curious your thoughts about, in terms of this particular measure and other things that we'll talk about during the course of not necessarily this show, but as we move forward with the legislature, how difficult is it going to be for Republican legislators to push back against a governor who is right now as strong as he is likely to ever be?
No, I think especially on the healthcare website issue, I think it's very, very likely that something will pass. And we need to note that there are areas of healthcare in Georgia that he is trying to address. I mean, he is proposing that the expansion of Medicaid coverage for pregnant women to address Georgia's abysmal maternal mortality rate. And one more thing to add on this website issue is, I think where Kemp's emphasis is on people with jobs in rural Georgia who still can't get health care coverage. this is a major problem, because it's so healthcare is so scarce in those areas, and the premiums are just extremely high because there's no competition. And this reinsurance issue is his effort to address that. So I think he's taking care of Republican business in that manner.
Adrian, I'm glad that Jim pointed out that Governor Kemp is promoting this measure that will give aid to pregnant women, will give them more protections under Medicaid, I believe. Because the reason I think that's important is because when the state passed the heartbeat law, that severe restriction on abortions in the state, there were many critics who said, all right, you've done that. Now, what is the state going to do to support the women, to provide services for women who are going to now have babies that may have been unwanted for whatever reason, economic and the like? So this is, I think, an important step for many people who have been critical of how much the state will do to support women in that situation.
I still feel like it falls along this, politics at base. Yes, you want to provide health care for mothers who are having issues, but, sometimes the need for abortion access is not about just about choice. It's about, health care access. Women who are, pregnant, they're not making a choice about whether they want a child or not. Perhaps they are in a medical emergency and need that care. So I think that, access for healthcare in Georgia needs to be opened up. If the state wants to provide something, I still don't understand why we can't have expansion in the meantime, for example.
Meg, while we're talking about abortion, I think we should point out that South Carolina had passed a similar 6-week ban on abortion, but the state Supreme Court overturned it. They said that the law banning abortions when cardiac activity is detected violated the state's constitution, the state constitution's right to privacy. And of course, there's a case pending in Georgia right now. It's not on privacy grounds so much as something else that we don't have to get into today, but help us with what's happening in South Carolina.
Certainly, yes. This so-called quote-unquote heartbeat bill, the same kind of thing that's been debated in a lot of places, was signed into law immediately after the legislature passed it, and then also litigation filed immediately thereafter, which we expect in these environments. So that litigation has been ongoing for a long time, and about a month ago almost, the state Supreme Court, as you note, ruled it unconstitutional. Currently, the Republican governor, Republican attorney general are asking for a rehearing in that case. Oftentimes, we see those requests, but not necessarily anything different happens. The state court composition will still be the same. But simultaneously to that, the Republican-controlled legislature in South Carolina is yet again debating more potential legislation related to abortions. And, it's kind of unknown at this time exactly what they'll be able to get passed that might meet court muster. So now that the U.S. Supreme Court has sent this issue back down to states, this is just one of those debates that we're seeing play out over and over in terms of perhaps what some members of a conservative legislature, even in this case, members of the state House and not the Senate, the sorts of restrictions that they want to implement, the Senate may or may not pass. But then once we get through that, there will be more litigation. And we've seen recently how that played out in South Carolina, at least with the 6-week ban.
Emma, I started the show by saying, now that we're 12 days into the session, we're starting to see things pick up considerably. But the one area where we have not seen anything pick up and aren't sure we will is around whether anybody's going to introduce further restrictions on abortion. The leadership in the House and Senate have said they want to wait to see what the Georgia Supreme Court does in the case that they have in front of them on whether the 6-week abortion ban here is legal or not. So we're not likely to see anything come up anytime soon on that front, yes?
Not anything that we believe would have movement, at least. I'm sure bills will be introduced. Bills have already been introduced to repeal the state's anti-abortion law by Democrats. And, you know, we're watching the abortion pill issue as well. But I think the state Supreme Court has scheduled its oral arguments on this case like the day before sine die. So seems unlikely that that would be opened up during the legislative session in a way that might have to result in legislation if they were to overturn it, for example. So at least this session, it does appear, you're right, that for once, what feels rare in the last few years of Georgia politics and other states as well, we won't be seeing a big fight, at least that is what it appears to be, caveat, caveat, caveat. But yeah, I do just when we, I wanted jump back quickly to Medicaid expansion to just say, I think what's interesting again about what Governor Kemp has been doing is that even though we've seen, you know, behind the scenes, I've reported on Republicans who have come around to Medicaid expansion, who realize that this makes sense for the state to do in their opinion, Governor Kemp is not budging. And that those are the signals that he's sending right and left. He sent his state of the state was very much, in that vein, and that it's not something that he seems willing to discuss, just as he has kept that position throughout his time in office.
Okay. Thank you for that. Jim, we've been talking a lot about gambling in Georgia for several sessions, if not longer, really. But in the last couple of sessions, sports betting has really risen to the surface as something which I think across party lines, an awful lot of people think we ought to finally do in this state, particularly since the United States Supreme Court issued its ruling a while back saying it was, in fact, legal. We now have a bill that would allow for sports betting in the state. And the question is going to be, one, does it have enough votes to pass? But number two, does it have enough votes to pass either as a constitutional amendment, which requires two-thirds of the body, or as former state Supreme Court Justice Harold Melton has argued, it doesn't need a constitutional amendment. It's really just an extension of lottery. Jim?
Yeah, that was the Melton's entrance into this issue was very, very interesting. I think he did it on behalf of the Metro Chamber of Commerce, Metro Atlanta Chamber of Commerce, and essentially what that does is it certainly gives permission to people who wanted to do so who wanted to support this, who have been eager to support this. And his argument is that you can craft gambling legislation that would really, in essence, be an extension of the Georgia Lottery, and. And I think this would be another cultural issue that would be immediately challenged in court, I think, by opposition, should it pass by a majority vote, as he suggests is possible.
Emma?
Yeah, it is interesting to see this year the sports betting folks trying to kind of take things solo away from casinos and horse racing in the hopes that that might pass in a clean way and actually be able to pass, because as we know, it all gets bogged down every year. Because these issues, I mean, these kinds of gambling are quite different and people have really different opinions about them. But the bill that's been introduced is not, my understanding is not the Metro Atlanta Chamber's bill. So we might even see further legislation on sports betting specifically. And on the other side though, you know, the casinos have a lot of lobbyists around the Capitol, and I've heard that there is some question that, you know, they might not be so happy with a clean sports betting bill going, because that might affect their ability to pass something in the years to come. Like, oh, we did a gambling bill, we're not going to talk about casinos now for a couple of years. So it doesn't seem there's still a legislative fight here to happen, but having the Metro Atlanta Chamber come out with the professional sports teams in Atlanta, I do think is a very notable coalition to watch, and coming out and saying, we just want a clean sports betting bill. Everyone's already betting. Let's get the tax revenue for it. But we shall see.
You know, Adrian and Meg, you're welcome to weigh in on this too. I had argued on this show for a while that the religious right would push back hard on this and might make it more difficult for any kind of gambling legislation to pass, given that they are a pretty powerful interest group. But I got schooled on that by a panel a while back that said to me, they're not what they used to be. You're overestimating what their influence might be. And I think that may very well be true. This isn't like the days when Zell Miller tried to initially pass the lottery and in his reelection bid really struggled because of the influence of the religious right. It'll be interesting to see if their power really is waning the way people have been telling me I ought to be aware of on this show.
I think that, every time the legislature takes a look at it, it becomes more friendly in the state. Right now it's got support from the lieutenant governor and the governor. I just think that if it doesn't happen now, it will happen eventually, even if there remains to be moral opposition from the religious right.
Meg, you want to weigh in before our break?
Sure. Yeah. You know, when I think about sports betting, it's always so interesting to watch different states handle this issue. And, particularly here in South Carolina, this is something that Democrats, and perhaps in particular the Democratic House Majority Leader, has been proposing for years. The Democratic nominee for governor was very bullish this past cycle about this being one of his potential platform tenets. And it's gone nowhere. He lost. Legislators aren't interested in debating it. And there was a study a couple of years ago going to your point about evangelicals and Christian conservatives and saying that there was a moral opposition to dealing with this issue. And that particularly is something I've heard among legislators in South Carolina. We're not interested in discussing this. We have more than just a political opposition to it. Yeah, the money would be great, but we're just not going to go there. And, so we'll see how it plays out here, Georgia, and a whole bunch of other places that have been considering taking this on.
Jim, I do have to get to a break, but look, you've been following all this longer than almost anybody. Give us your thoughts on that.
Well, first of all, to your point, yeah, I think evangelical influence in our state capital has declined since 2004. That was kind of when it hit its peak with the state constitutional ban on gay marriage, and what you do have to work into this is the economic development issue, is the thirst for jobs and any kind of expansion of jobs. And I think this may be one place where sports betting is at a disadvantage, because Emma can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't see them addressing using this as citing any job increases with this, whereas horse racing and casinos, you are talking about a good deal of tourism at stake.
I think that's right.
Yeah, the argument is just workforce. Yeah, the argument is just from sports betting workforce development because of the money going to the lottery to Hope Scholarship, pre-K, and perhaps needs-based aid. So that's the argument.
Natalie Mendenhall is frantically signaling me I'm very late for our first break. Let's get to it right now.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind. If you like this show, you'll also like Georgia Today. It's a daily podcast from GPB News, bringing you compelling stories and in-depth reporting that you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Peter Biello, for this quick and convenient way to get the best of GPB News' extensive coverage of the topics that matter to you, delivered directly to your device every weekday afternoon.
Emma Hurt, Adrian Jones, Jim Galloway, and Meg Kinnard join us for today's Political Rewind. Meg, you're based in South Carolina, but of course you're a national politics reporter for Associated Press. But because you are in South Carolina, I want to start with you. You were at the Trump event in South Carolina. He did two events last weekend, of course, New Hampshire, then in South Carolina. We know they were small scale, none of this big rally kind of thing that he's done in the past. Tell us a little bit about what you saw of Trump on your day with him. And then we're going to turn it to how Georgia Republicans are feeling about Trump's bid for re-election. Go ahead.
This was a very different vibe from anybody who watched in 2016 and 2020 and the tens of thousands of people who would show up at airplane hangars, high school gyms, big venues like that. This was inside the South Carolina State House, invitation only. Plenty of supporters, probably more than 100, I would gauge, but lots of people turned away who wanted to get in but hadn't been invited. And while the messaging from the former president, the issues that he hit on, a lot of them were the same, what we've heard in cycles past, the delivery was different. And it's, of course, something you're, you know, going to be dealing with circumstantially with a couple hundred people versus thousands. I mean, there's no chanting and the crowd reacts and all those kinds of things. But from the get-go, the Trump campaign has said that this one is going to look different. He did roll out a state leadership team with the governor, the lieutenant governor, multiple members of Congress, Senator Lindsey Graham, coming out with a show of force in terms of official endorsements from people in this state who carry a lot of heft with the Republican electorate. So as the first official candidate in the race, that's intentional. And it's also a signal to other candidates expected to come, even ones from within South Carolina, like former Governor Nikki Haley, who's expected to announce here in a few weeks. So it's a different look, but there's still a lot of those same elements that we've seen from the Trump campaign. And, you know, it's similar to Bluestein's reporting about Georgia Republicans. I'm hearing a lot of similar messages from other Republicans in South Carolina about how they're feeling and kind of waiting to see, as opposed to jumping right in, even though they endorsed the former president before. They may be waiting a little bit longer this time.
His messaging still has to do with having the 2020 election stolen from him, I believe, which is truly dismaying to many Republicans who are worried that he's got to get off of that hobby horse. Yes.
There were some comments to that effect for sure. And it's definitely something that we've seen on his social media accounts and from his supporters. Certainly that's still part of the former president's effort, but his campaign, too, has said that there's more of a focus on spinning forward. And articles I've read recently asked, even by us at the AP for other reporting we've done about things related to the 2020 election and these claims and things being unproven. His official spokesman for the campaign is saying, we're looking forward to the next one and not really focusing so much on the past. So, yeah, that's just one circumstance, one comment for one story. But we may start to see a spin forward in that way, even officially from the campaign. There's still going to be plenty of people committed to talking and relitigating and rediscussing the 2020 election. But I think for this cycle, with what's sure to be a fairly large Republican field, the sentiment of many of those potential voters is, okay, that's great. Whatever happened, happened, but let's please try to win this one in 2024.
Jim, the latest AJC polling, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but they show that a very large majority of Republicans in Georgia still have very strong feelings about Donald Trump. They still really support him as in terms of the work he did as president. Now, whether or not they're lining up to vote for him in a primary is another question. But Greg Bluestein, as Meg pointed out, reported out a piece on Georgia Republicans within the party. And here's basically a line or two from what he said. He said that several people within the Georgia party said that Trump is, quote, irrevocably tainted by the ongoing criminal and civil investigations into his actions during and after his presidency. And Greg quoted a number of people, including Colt Chambers, who's a former chair of the Georgia Young Republicans, who said Trump has done enough damage to our party and country post-presidency. There's a good chance he could win the primary, Chambers said, but quite frankly, there's no way he could win the general. We know this from the many races in 2022 that he lost when he made endorsements for candidates. But maybe most important was Governor Kemp, Jim, who Greg quotes as saying, to save our country from the disasters of the Biden administration, we must have a Republican nominee who can win the general election. Voters' frustrations with the direction of our country want to hear what we are for and what we're going to do in the future to help them and their families get good-paying jobs, live in a safe community, and achieve the American dream. So jump in.
Yeah, isn't that an interesting wording there? There are two things that I think that make Georgia maybe a little more unique even than South Carolina. Number one, we do have the legislature in session right now, and you're not going to see many Republican lawmakers come out and cheer Trump on when they've got legislation that might have to go in front of Brian Kemp later this spring. So that's one thing. Then you've got the Fani Willis investigation into Donald Trump. This is a local issue that will carry a whole lot of weight. I think it's even among Republicans. Once she makes her decision on whether to indict anybody who gets indicted.
Emma.
I think that it's striking really to see Brian Kemp say things like that, because as we know, he has tied himself into knots not to say anything negative about Trump to this point, even as Trump was saying everything negative he could think of about Kemp publicly and repeatedly. So this is a real pivot point, I think, in Kemp's assessment of Trump's prospects in a primary, that he thinks that if he comes out in this way, he might be able to exert some influence over what happens. And we know there's lots of talk about his newfound national influence in the Republican Party, and we'll see how he decides to exert that influence, whether through his federal PAC endorsements. You know, the rumors of him running in 2024 still persist as well. But to me, that is like a lightning bolt of a statement, because it really signifies that things have changed. Whereas before, the power of Trump, at least in Georgia, was something that Republicans, including Kemp, were very wary of crossing, even when Trump had already kind of crossed that Rubicon himself. But now Kemp seems to see a path for him to speak out a bit more.
Adrian?
I mean, I also think that the president has, you know, treated the governor so poorly in a situation where the governor does have residence in the state of Georgia, as well as the Secretary of State. You know, he caused people to have doubt, for example, in our electoral system, which I feel like the Secretary of State is taking pains to make clear. And we've seen recent polls that people do, in fact, trust the Georgia system. And so I feel like there's more room in Georgia to understand that perhaps, you know, Trump's candidates, his continuous in the same line that he's been doing since 2016, 2020, don't resonate as well here. And, you know, the governor definitely has potential national aspirations, whether that's a Senate seat or the presidency. And I think that Georgia's have a little bit more elbow room to move against Trump, especially based upon the way that he's talked about and treated representatives in our state.
It's going to be fascinating to watch it play out, because I think much like South Carolina, where you've got leaders like a Lindsey Graham who are lining up immediately with Trump, there are going to be other Republicans in that state, in your state, Meg, who will not jump on the Trump bandwagon quickly, I would guess. And Jim, we're going to see the same thing happen here, an ongoing split among Republicans. I can't imagine, Jim, for instance, a David Schaefer, the chair of the party, at least as of right now, turning his back on Trump at this point.
No, and you have you have Brian Kemp as governor, but you also have Marjorie Taylor Greene up in D.C. making all sorts of splashes, and she has bonded herself to Trump just as closely as she's bonded herself to Kevin McCarthy.
Okay, we got to get to the final break of the show. I have too many more things I want to talk about with this panel. We'll get to at least some of them after these messages. Jim Galloway, let's briefly mention that federal judge Steve Jones, who's a Georgia federal judge, has just heard a case. And he hasn't ruled yet, so we'll sort of mention it now and then follow up as we get a ruling. But the case is about the Texas-based organization True the vote, which has been one of the largest voices in saying the 2020 election was stolen. Did they, in fact, try to intimidate voters and suppress turnout in 2021 before the runoff election for U.S. Senate when they challenged something like 360,000 voter registrations in the state of Georgia alone? Stacey Abrams organization, other voting rights groups have claimed in a lawsuit that that's exactly what True the Vote was doing. True the Vote says, no, we were simply exercising our constitutional right and our right under Georgia law to make sure people were voting legally. So just give us a little on that, Jim.
Okay, just two things very quickly. Number one, months after this is all about the January 5th, 2001 runoff, Senate runoffs.
Right.
And months after that, Georgia passed a new election law in which it specifically said a citizen can make an unlimited number of challenges to voter registration. And this is, I think we just found out what was behind all that. And if I could bore you a little bit with a bit of history. In January 1946, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled unconstitutional the Georgia's white-only Democratic primary. And there was the same year as a governor's race. The result was that Gene Talmadge, who ultimately won that race, although he died before he could serve, Gene Talmadge initiated a massive voter registration suppression effort aimed at the 200,000 black voters who were registered in the state. They sent out mimeographed forms. All you had to do was fill in the name of the challenged voter, and that was their method of addressing the black entry into Georgia politics. So there's a Emma? Precedent for this.
Yeah, Emma.
The only thing I'll just add is that what I'm watching now is we do know that the Secretary of State has said this is the one part of SB 202 that he thinks needs to be revisited, at least that he said publicly that he thinks needs to be revisited. I think he'd probably like to be back on the state election board too, but this is one thing. there needs to be guardrails, he said, on challenges, when they can happen, and how municipalities and election boards have to respond. However, the question is, like, is there political will to reopen that part of the code section? And that remains an open question. This session, can the Secretary of State make that change happen? Will anyone go along with it?
Adrian, in the 2022 midterm election, there were something like 70,000 registrations that were challenged, not by True the Vote, but in the midterm election and back in the 2021 runoff, virtually a very tiny number of the people challenged ended up not being said they were legitimate voters. Although the lawsuit says there was one case in which a woman was pulled out of a voter line because she'd been challenged her registration and had to wait hours to get it resolved before she was allowed to cast her ballot. So the litigants see that as a sign that there's definitely intimidation and suppression. We'll see. Steve Jones has it in his power to decide.
Absolutely. And obviously I'm not Judge Jones, but it seemed as if, in my research on the topic, that it was designed to be to create intimidation. These submissions were almost 90% rejected. We don't really have good information about the last 10%. You know, were those people easily able to re-register to vote? But the threat of having your vote challenged, the possibility of being pulled out of line and seeing that as an example, I think all of these suppressed votes make people nervous about whether or not they have access to the polls. And, you know, it's generally harassment. And, you know, the National Party was forbidden by that consent decree since 82 until 2018 to be at the polls. because of intimidation and problems. And I think this is an extension of that, even though, you know, under the Georgia law, people weren't actually physically able to be there to challenge voters. But that wasn't clear until pretty close to the election. So I think that it's just an additional way to dissuade people from being confident about the status of their registration and their ability to access the polls.
Well, another very basic aspect of these challenges is it puts even more work on already overburdened election workers around the state of Georgia and other states where this sort of thing is happening. Meg, let's talk about Marjorie Taylor Greene for a couple of minutes here. We know she's back on the committees because she's become Kevin McCarthy's best friend in the U.S. House. So he put her back on some pretty significant committees. And I guess it's maybe not surprising that in her first appearance on a committee, she's on the House Oversight Committee. An issue came up in which Democrats complained about the Republican decision to disband a subcommittee that had jurisdiction over civil rights, civil liberties, and the like. And a Democrat on that committee, Jasmine Crockett, cited the police custody death of Tyre Nichols as the kind of case that justified the subcommittee's existence. Sounds right. But Marjorie Taylor Greene said, yes, Nichols' death was tragic, but she compared the fact that the Memphis officers were quickly fired and then charged with murder to the fact that no criminal action was taken against the Capitol Hill police officer who shot and killed Ashley Babbitt, a protester trying to get in to the House chamber and trying to get through a broken window. And here's what Green said. I believe there are many people that came into the Capitol on January 6th whose civil rights and liberties are being violated heavily. And this committee should look into those civil rights abuses. She can't help herself, Meg.
This is, you know, it's certainly some interesting messaging. I will say that. And to be noted, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy has come out and said that this is, you know, that these are not similar situations. This is not the same. And so, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene being aligned with former President Trump, as well as House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, that's an interesting spot for her to be in. But let's be clear, Marjorie Taylor Greene is known for being a representative who is very good at focusing attention on herself, at making comments that are sure to be taken note of by various constituencies. And also, in the wake of January 6th, and all of the strong feelings that still exist about what happened that day and the arguments from folks such as the congresswoman that, you know, this was not intended to be what Democrats have made it out to be. It's an unfortunate attempt at comparison in those two circumstances, which are incredibly different. But it also is, you know, here we are talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene in a Republican Congress.
Again,
I don't think that's an accident.
Again. All right. Thank you for that. All right, Emma Hurt, we're close out of time, but you wrote a piece in Axios Atlanta the other day, and I'm going to ask you about it now. Why should Atlanta, not Chicago, my hometown, Natalie Mendenhall's hometown, not why should it be Atlanta in 2024 for the Democratic National Convention?
Oh, well, could we just list the reasons? I mean, from our pizza, of course, which is obviously so much better. That's not a controversial statement at all. Nobody has anything to say about that. Your metro connection, obviously, from airport to downtown, et cetera, et cetera. And Chicago's just had too many of them. I just think they've had more than their fair share, and Atlanta needs its due. And also, since the Democratic plans to move the early presidential primary up in Georgia seem kind of ill-fated based on the Republican side of this equation, this could be a nice consolation prize for Georgia, for Georgia Democrats who are unlikely, it appears, to get that early presidential primary.
I wish we had time to just let you talk a little more about it, but what I'm going to ask is that we put up a link on social media, Natalie and Chase, because it's really fun. And I think the argument for why not Chicago is as much fun as the argument for Atlanta. My thought, to be honest with you, I don't know if you all saw that Jane Fonda the other day was quoted in an article in the AJC. She's in this new picture, 80 for Brady, in which she and three older women go to see Tom Brady in the Super Bowl in 2017. And she said she feels conflicted because that's the Super Bowl in which Tom Brady led the biggest comeback in the second half of a game against the Atlanta Falcons and won. That's kind of how I'm feeling right now about this battle between Chicago and Atlanta for the convention. Finally, one last note. Jim Galloway, 538, as they so often do, did a great job breaking down the success rate of Punxsutawney Phil in predicting whether we're going to have six more weeks of winter. And you know what they found out in their big data crunching? That, in fact, General Beauregard here in the Atlanta area has a better prediction rate than Punxsutawney Phil.
Okay, my question is could we incorporate this Groundhog Day into sports betting, into a sports betting bill? I think that'd be worthwhile.
Maybe that's a political element.
Yeah.
We should post a link to that too, because you will not believe, unless you read it, the depth to which 538 goes into crunching the numbers around this. All right, I'm sorry to say we're completely out of time for today's show, but we are. And I'm really grateful to all of you for being here. Adrian Jones, Meg Kennard, Jim Galloway, Emma Hurt, thanks for a really good way to end the week. And thanks to our team, Victoria Evans Cash, Jake Cook, Chase McGee, and Natalie Mendenhall, for your work this week on Political Rewind. We'll be back again on Monday with a brand new show. In the meantime, I hope you all have a really wonderful weekend, and I hope it is a safe and relaxing one. Bye-bye, everybody.